There we go. All right, can you hear me now? You probably could hear me anyhow, right? I'm kind of a loud mouth. I've been told that before. My wife says that every once in a while about me. It's been a pleasure to be with you here the last several weeks. This is my last week with you here as we have the opportunity to walk the land of Israel with Jesus. And my plan here for this evening is to spend our time in Jerusalem as we reflect together and visit together the places where Jesus walked on Thursday, Friday, and Sunday of what we call Holy Week. Okay? So here's a map. Do you like maps? I like maps. I hate GPSs. You won't find a GPS in our car. As I've said before many times, I've ended up in a cornfield following a GPS. So I don't trust them, but I really like maps. And so here's a map, right? And this is a map of Jerusalem during the time of Jesus. And you see the city walls around the city of Jerusalem. This is a reconstruction based on the extensive archaeology that's been done in and around Jerusalem. The city walls, the outline of the city of Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. We can actually follow through the timeline here of key events in the last couple of days of the earthly ministry of Jesus, and we can identify the locations generally of where some of these key events took place. And this is what I'd like to walk through with you here this evening, and then show some pictures of what you might see today as you were, if you had opportunity to visit some of these locations. Okay, so the eight key events that took place during Thursday and Friday and then Sunday of Holy Week. Jesus gathers with his disciples in the upper room, and we have the institution of the Lord's Supper Thursday evening, and we can identify pretty close location of where that took place, right here, in what's called the Essene Quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem on the Western Hill. Right in this location, you can visit. There's a structure built on a much older structure, right, that dates back to the Byzantine era, and really good tradition that goes way back to the early 300s, and we'll take a look, we'll visit that together. The upper room right here. Of course, we know that Jesus, after he institutes the Lord's Supper and after Judas departs, the disciples then go to spend the evening in the Garden of Gethsemane, which is located right here at the foot of the Mount of Olives. And so we're not quite sure the route that Jesus took in order to get from there to here. There's a couple of different ways that Jesus could have traveled. He could have just gone through the old city and then come out one of the gates located over here and made his way to the Garden of Gethsemane. But, you know, have you ever tried to travel through a center city? Not an easy way to go. So most scholars believe that Jesus actually departed the upper room through a gate here called the Essene Gate and then traveled around the outside of the city wall up the Kidron Valley to the Garden of Gethsemane. Okay? Then we know that Jesus is arrested at the Garden of Gethsemane, where he is taken then to the high priest Caiaphas's home. Archaeologists have actually excavated an area that is believed, again, tradition goes way back to the early 300s, of the home of Caiaphas, the high priest. Extensive excavations have been done there around a church that's been built over the top of Caiaphas's home, the Church of St. Peter at Gallicantu, which we'll visit here in a little bit. And then after being arrested and being held for trial and Peter denying Jesus three times at Caiaphas's home right here, Jesus is taken before Pilate, and there's a trial. The first part of a trial held with Pilate, and there's dispute, there's scholarly dispute about where that trial takes place. Many of us who have visited Israel, the popular view is that the trial is held here at the Antonia Fortress. I actually don't think that's where it took place, even though that's kind of the popularized view. The Antonia Fortress is where the Roman soldiers kind of hang out during the high Jewish holidays because of its close proximity to the temple. And so if trouble emerges at the temple, the soldiers are able to run from the Antonia Fortress down into the temple complex and take care of any kind of difficulties that might emerge, right? So the traditional view is that this is where Jesus meets Pontius Pilate. I don't think it is. I believe, and I think there's growing scholarly consensus on this point, that Jesus met with Pontius Pilate actually right here. This is Herod the Great's palace. By the time of Jesus, by the time of Pontius Pilate, Herod the Great is long dead. His son Archelaus, who inherited Herod's palace, had been long deposed. And so if Herod the Great builds himself a palace, where is Herod the Great going to hang out? In his luscious, beautiful, amazing palace, which is located right here. Where is Archelaus, his son, when he inherits the kingdom? Where is he going to hang out? Where is he going to live? He's going to live where his dad lived. Archelaus is deposed, and a Roman governor now rules over Judea. Where is the Roman governor going to go to live? He's going to go into this luscious, beautiful, amazing palace. And so Herod the Great, or dead, Archelaus dead, but they both resided in this palace that Herod the Great built. Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, I believe, lived right here during the time of the high holidays. And so that is where Jesus is brought for trial. By the way, when I was in Israel last spring, archaeologists were digging up a parking lot. And that parking lot is right here. And as they dug down, they discovered beautiful mosaic floor that dates back to the time of the first century, probably part of the mosaic floor that was in Herod the Great's palace. Very ornate, very expensive looking, very beautiful. So where's Pontius Pilate? Is Pontius Pilate going to hang out with all the foot soldiers where all the trouble is? No. It's good to be the king, and it's good to be the governor. And so Pontius Pilate is here, and that is where Jesus is brought for trial. After this audience with Pilate, you might remember that Pilate realizes that Herod Antipas is in town. Herod Antipas and his palace is right over here. Jesus is taken from here to here, and then Jesus is sent back from here back to Pilate. And it's here in this location where ultimately Pilate condemns Jesus to death. Jesus is scourged. He's prepared for the cross here. And then Jesus is taken from outside of the city along what is now this area up to Golgotha or Calvary, which in the first century is outside the city walls. Outside the city walls, right here, Golgotha or Calvary. And you'll notice on this particular map, Calvary or Golgotha, if you can read that really small print, is right beside the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. Right beside each other. And this is actually grounded not only in the archaeology, but it's grounded in the text of John. In John's gospel, it says, in the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden. Did you notice that? It gives the impression that the place of the crucifixion is very close in proximity to the place of the burial. In the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden. It was in this garden, right, the unused tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, where Jesus is buried. Today there is a massive church, a fourth century church built by Helena, that is so large and so massive that it contains within its walls both the historical location of Calvary and the place of the tomb, with very, very old tradition that goes back to the second century AD of where Calvary is located and where the burial place of Jesus is located. So that gives you a little bit of the movement of Jesus from Thursday to Friday and then to Sunday. Would you like to see what you might encounter if you visit these places today? Yes? Or you're ready to go home? No, you're not ready to go home. I have you till 7, right? Okay, so first of all, the upper room. Of course, the original structure of the upper room does not exist today, right? But very early tradition, right, that dates back to at least the 4th century AD, right, captivated the thinking of the Crusaders. And so when the Crusaders took Jerusalem, one of the first things that they did is they built churches, they built shrines, they built chapels over earlier Christian sites, right, that commemorated and contained the memory of important events of the life of Jesus. And one of these Crusader-era sites is this one, right? The upper room, it's a structure built on a much older 4th century chapel, and it looks something like this. Clearly Crusader, clearly much later. This is maybe built in the 10th century AD, right? But I just want to point out an interesting architectural feature here. As you go into this upper room, again, built over a much older structure, you see Crusader-era iconography or symbols, including, right, on some of these columns, pelicans. Pelicans. Here's some pelicans at the top of this column. And you might wonder, pelicans? What's the significance of a pelican? Well, in the Crusader period, popular stories about pelicans, no one's ever actually seen this happen, but popular stories about pelicans, that pelican mothers, right, the hen, right, if there's a famine, if there's not much food, opportunity to feed the chicks when they're younger, the pelican hen will use her beak to prick her breast until she bleeds, and then the pelican chicks will drink the blood that comes from the pelican hen's chest, right? And that story, that kind of folklore that surrounded pelican hens sacrificing a bit of themselves for their chicks, impressed the Crusaders, impressed medieval Christians. And so you can see the parallel here, right? Right? Jesus is like the pelican in the sense that Jesus sacrifices of his blood, right, for the sake of his people. And so we see in Crusader era iconography the image of a pelican, right, in Christian buildings, in Christian architecture. It even shows up here in the upper room, this building that dates to about the 10th century AD. Okay, so that's the upper room. The second piece, the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus makes his way from the upper room, probably out the city gate and around to the Garden of Gethsemane at the foot of the Mount of Olives. And if you were to visit the Mount of Olives today, this is what you would see. You would see something that looks like this. Right-hand side, there's a garden of very old olive trees. Some of these olive trees may be as old as 1,000 years old. Certainly not olive trees from the time of Jesus. But the space, right? The space of the Garden of Gethsemane couldn't be that large. This is a general location, right, of where the Garden of Gethsemane might look like, what it might look like today. There's a church, of course, there's always a church. There's a church built in the early 20th century over top a Byzantine church built in the 4th century. This church, built in the 20th century, did you hear me? 20th century, right? A long time after the time of Jesus. But again, built on the footprint of a much older church, dates back to around 400 AD. This early 20th century church is called the Church of All Nations. It's a Roman Catholic church. Money was donated from all over the Christian world to build this church, early part of the 20th century. As you walk in the back of the church, which, by the way, is dim, it's dark. There's not much light. And there's a reason for that, right? Jesus spends the evening in the Garden of Gethsemane, and it's here that he engages in great travail, right? As he prays to his Father, right? If it's your will, Father, would you take this cup from me? And ultimately, Jesus that evening submits his will to the Father's will. Not my will, but your will be done. So this church is very dark, and as you walk in and you look at the ceiling, you'll see coat of arms of all the different countries that donated to the building of this church, including the Roman Catholic Church here in the United States. If you walk in the back of the church and look off to the right, you can see the coat of arms of the U.S. This is a picture from the back of that church looking to the front. The very front of this church, there's a large limestone outcropping that, according to tradition, is the place where Jesus knelt to pray. Maybe. General location, yes. Is this the spot? I'm not sure I would go to the rack for that. Here's the front of the church. I find the front of this church to be just beautiful, right? It's a large mosaic along the front of the church that has a statue to each of the four gospel writers. And then it has various figures from philosophy, Plato and Aristotle and others, kneeling at the foot of Jesus, who is the source of all wisdom. This we have the facade, the front of the Church of All Nations, or the Garden of Gethsemane Church. That's what you would see if you were to visit here today. Then we have Caiaphas' home. Jesus is arrested here, and he's brought all the way back around and into the Essene Quarter, where we have the high priest's home, Caiaphas' house. Jesus is held there. And this is also the place, of course, where Peter, St. Peter, only comes so far, right? He comes into the courtyard of Caiaphas' home, and it's in the courtyard where Peter denies Jesus three times before the rooster crows. And so we have a church, another church, built on the location, the general location of where Caiaphas' home was. And we know that there was a magnificent first century home, right? Archaeology has shown that. And this home had dungeons in the basement. Archaeologists have shown that. Major first century steps and a road that leads right past this home. So a lot of good reason to think that this is a pretty good location for a very important first century figure. Maybe it's the house of Caiaphas, and so maybe the Roman Catholics chose a good spot when they built this church. Again, this church is called the Church of St. Peter in Gallicantu. How's your Latin? Gallicantu. The rooster crow, right? So Gallicantu, or the rooster song, right? Right, the Church of St. Peter of the rooster song, Gallicantu. This church commemorates where Jesus is held before Caiaphas, where Peter denies Jesus three times before the rooster crows. By the way, I was reading the story once in a little devotional area outside this church. I was reading the story of Peter denying Jesus three times, and this is the absolute truth. A rooster started crowing as I was reading the story. Right? There's an Arab family that lives just next door to this church, and they had some chickens. And so I get to the climax of that story of Peter denying Jesus three times, and then lo and behold, some real live roosters start to crow. Right? How amazing was that? If you go inside the church, the dominant feature in the middle of this church is a pit. Right? There's a hole in the floor in the middle of this church, and you can look down into this hole into a dungeon area. Right? That according to tradition, this is the dungeon area where Jesus was held, right, on the night that he was arrested. And there is some 4th century iconography. Some crosses that have been scratched into the wall of this pit, right? Is this the actual place? I wouldn't go to the rack for it. But there is early evidence that this is pretty close to the location of where Jesus was held by Caiaphas. So the Church of St. Peter at Gallicantu. Next. Jesus is taken from Caiaphas's home to, I believe, Herod the Great's old palace, where Pilate is hanging out, right, enjoying the luxuries of a Judean palace. And it's here that Jesus is presented before Pilate, right here. If you were to visit there today, here's what you would see. Right, the perspective of these photos are from outside of the city wall, which here on the northern side of the city of Jerusalem actually corresponds very nicely to the way that the wall would have appeared in the first century. The newer wall, which was only built in the 1500s, right, is built right on top of the much older wall that's first century. You can actually see a royal entrance area, a promenade that leads through the foundations of a wall structure that lead, including steps, up to this area right here, where you can see the first century foundations of a staircase that lead up and into ultimately the other side of this wall structure. And so the growing consensus here, pretty good case can be made that when Jesus is brought before Pilate, he's brought along this promenade up these steps into this space where there was once a doorway, and then up these steps, imagine there's a doorway here, and into the presence of Pilate. And most likely, because you remember, the Jewish leadership not willing to go inside because a Gentile lived there and they did not want to be ceremonially impure. They wanted to be able to observe the Passover. So most likely, the trial takes place where Pilate presents Jesus standing right in this general location with all the crowds of people standing in this location saying, "Crucify him. Give us Barabbas, not Jesus." Probably all of that takes place right here. One of the few places where you can say with a very high degree of certainty, Jesus walked here. So Jesus is taken there, he's taken over to Herod Antipas, he's brought back to Pilate, where Pilate ultimately condemns Jesus to death. And then Jesus is taken from here over to Calvary, where he's nailed upon a cross, where he eventually gives his life as a ransom for many, and then is buried in the garden just adjacent to Calvary in an unused tomb, a tomb that belonged to Joseph of Arimathea. So if you were to visit this today, what would you see? Well, first of all, you need to remember that there are two churches that still remain today that were built by Helena, the mother of Constantine. Remember, Constantine was the first Roman emperor. His mother was a devout Christian, Helena. When her son became the emperor, one of the first things that she did was she made a pilgrimage to Israel and started to go around asking, where did this happen? Where did that happen? Where did another thing happen? And she commissioned churches to be built on those locations to commemorate where these various events of the gospel took place. Only two of those churches remain to this day. One we've already experienced several weeks ago when we visited Bethlehem, the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, the oldest continuously functioning church in the world that dates back to the 300s AD. There's still a congregation that meets there, even to this day. The other church that remains is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but it had various interruptions over time. So we can't say that it's a continuing church throughout the ages from the time of Helena. Various interruptions in the functioning of this church. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, though, built in the 4th century, as was the Church of the Nativity, by Helena, the mother of Constantine, largely destroyed by Muslims in the 1000s. Okay, largely destroyed. Notice that I said largely destroyed, not completely destroyed. There were parts of it that still remained and partially in function at that time, rebuilt by his son. And then even to this day, there's an ongoing effort to update, to renovate, to fix this very, very old structure. So here's a kind of map of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, because it's massive and very confusing. If you were to visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you would easily get disoriented as you go into this church. So let me try to walk you through, right, what you might see when you go into this church, and then I'll throw some pictures up on the slide here for you. Okay. So now imagine that this is what the church looks like today in its floor plan, but I want you to imagine that when it was originally built in the 4th century, it's double this size. Okay? So imagine that the church actually extends all this way, with the entrance of the church being back here. This is how you would come into the church. All of this destroyed by the Muslims in the 1000s. This part reconstructed, right? The roofing structure put back on, domes reconstructed, etc. Today, rather than the entrance being over here, the main entrance into this church is actually here. There's a courtyard located right here on the western side of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You walk in through a door. You immediately turn right. Some of you I see nodding who've been there before with us. You immediately turn right as soon as you walk in the door, and you go up into what is kind of like a loft area, right? Kind of like a loft area. And up in this loft area, right, there's a shrine built over a limestone outcropping, which has very, very old tradition that goes back way before the time of Helena as being the place of Calvary. And this is another place where I think, actually, the archaeology and the tradition gives us a very high degree of certainty that this is the place. Somewhere in and around this limestone outcropping where Jesus was crucified. Then you make your way past the shrine, you go back down the steps, and this is where it starts to get a little bit weird, where my Protestant sensibilities start to go sideways, and you start to have weird stuff, and we'll talk about that weird stuff here in just a minute. You walk by some weird stuff, and you go over into this large atrium where there's a small chapel built over the archaeological remains of the burial place of Jesus. Small chapel built over the archaeological remains of the tomb of Jesus. One of the reasons why we can say that with a great degree of certainty that this is both the place of Calvary as well as the place of the burial of Jesus is that archaeologists have done excavations both underground this church and around the outside of the church, and lo and behold, they've identified first century Jewish tombs. So these are first century Jewish tombs in this area. So if Jesus is going to be buried anywhere, this is where it would be. Right? So you can actually go inside this chapel and see the location of where, according to tradition, Jesus was buried. And again, very, very old tradition. Now you want to see what all this looks like? Here are some pictures for you. So here's the courtyard that I mentioned. Right now the entrance, it's on the western side of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You can see the doorway there that's opened. Do you see, if you look really closely, the ladder? Do you see it? You can barely make it out. There's a ladder right here. Do you see it? I know it's really small, but there's a ladder right here that is on kind of this, oh, what would you call this? This ledge, ladder right here that leads up into that window. Can you see it? If you look really closely, those of you with good eye, that ladder has been there since the 1850s. And the reason why is about five different Christian denominations have control of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and they can't get along. So no one knows whose ladder that was. And so rather than get into a fight about whose ladder it is, there it sits since the 1850s. In the 1850s, they developed a schedule of who can do what, when, in this massive church. And so the Copts, right, the Egyptian Coptics, have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre for a certain period of time. The Armenian Orthodox have it for a certain period of time. The Roman Catholics, certain period of time. The Greek Orthodox, certain period of time. Right? That agreement was made in the 1850s. And every once in a while, if the sermon goes over a little bit, fisticuffs break out because the Roman Catholics get mad because the Greek Orthodox are using a space and it's beyond the time of allotment. So you can go on YouTube and actually people have videotaped, right, the strange picture of the Roman Catholic priests and the Greek Orthodox priests, you know, looking like an MMA, you know, kind of ring battle there. It's strange but very sad. To make it even more strange and comical, this is the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and the Coptic Orthodox Church, the Ethiopian Christians, have control of the roof. There's actually some hermits that live in some of these small cubicles here. To make it even worse, and we joke around about this, but it's certainly sad. Christians couldn't agree together back in the 1850s or so. Who should get the keys to the church? So they gave the keys to the church to a Muslim family. And so the Muslims actually have control of the keys to the church, and a Muslim comes and unlocks it every morning, locks it up every evening. As a matter of fact, I got a picture right here. That's the holder of the keys. This is a descendant of the original family, given the keys, the Muslim family given to the keys, passed down from generation to generation. I happened to meet the guy. I got my son to take a picture of this guy. This is the holder of the keys, right? This Muslim family. He doesn't look very happy, does he? Okay. So you go inside these double doors, and you make an immediate right. You go up into the loft, and you encounter a shrine, as I've mentioned. There's plexiglass over the shrine. There's an altar there. There's a hole under the altar. You can reach your hand down through the hole in the altar and touch Calvary there. You come down from the lobby, and again, this is where it starts to get really weird. There's a slab of marble that's several hundred years old. This slab of marble commemorates the place where Jesus' body was brought down from Calvary, and his body was prepared for burial. Really strange superstitions connected with this slab. In the Russian Orthodox Church, there's the belief that if you take your babushka, you know, handkerchief off and rub it on the stone, and then you take that handkerchief back home and give it to a woman who has trouble having children, she'll have children. Right? So it solves the problem of barren women. Right? So superstition that's often attached to these strange things. I saw a couple of Russian Orthodox nuns laying on top of this slab, pretending like they were taking a bath. And I asked what was going on, and somebody said, well, she's pretending to wash herself in the blood of the Lamb as she's laying on this stone slab. So you see some stuff that kind of grates against our Protestant sensibilities here. And then you come to that small chapel. There's a chapel inside this church, very old chapel, built inside this much larger, massive church. Inside this chapel is the burial place of Jesus, according to very old tradition. I mentioned to you that we know that this is at least a first century burial site. Just to the side of the church, archaeological work has been done. Here's the entrance to a first century Jewish tomb. So we know that this general area where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was constructed was indeed a Jewish first century tomb area. Here we are in the front of this small chapel. See people going into it. And then as you go in, this is what you would experience. The right-hand side, you might not be able to see this very well, but there's a small doorway. You enter in. As you enter in, you turn immediately to the right, and there's another stone shrine over top of the place that traditionally was where Jesus was laid to rest. To give you a sense of what this might not have looked like with all the thrills and bells and smells, just outside of the city of Jerusalem, There's what's called the Garden Tomb. This is another first century Jewish tomb without a massive church, without all of the superstition, without all of the stuff that goes along with Greek Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism sometimes. you can see what a first century Jewish tomb might have looked like without all of those smells and bells. Right here we see an entrance into a limestone cliff. You see a curb here, and you can imagine that there might have been a large stone that was rolled in front of the entryway. And then when you walk in, you turn immediately to the right, and you see two indentations here where bodies would have been laid in the ancient world, with a walking space here in between. This gives you a sense of what the tomb might have looked like where Jesus was laid. So that's what you would see, right, in Jerusalem, these various locations. You've read the stories, you're familiar with them, and we've had an opportunity to see what those places look like today. Now, for those of you who have visited Israel with us, there's a few of them right here, right? And maybe some of you will visit at some point, right? It's difficult. It's kind of strange because you have to kind of get beyond, you know, what people have done to these sites in turning many of them into superstitious kinds of places. But once you get past all of that, once you kind of winnow away and pull away the different layers of the onion, you recognize that in many of these places, there's very, very old tradition that goes back in saying, this is the place where Jesus walked. This is the place where Jesus died on a cross. This is the place where Jesus was buried and rose again. And it reminds us, again, once you get back past all of that superstitious stuff, it reminds us of the historicity of all this stuff, which in my view is the most important thing. Right? The Apostle Paul makes the argument in 1 Corinthians 15 that if this stuff didn't happen, if there was no such thing as a resurrection, then we are fools. And we should be pitied because we believe in a lie. So these locations, these sites, give me a certain degree of hope, even though you see all of this superstition that kind of has been layered on top of it, because it reminds me that the stuff that we believe really, really happened. Amen. Really happened. And so to close on this theme of these things really happening in real space and real time, what did happen? One of my favorite passages from the Bible, which I think captures the essence of the gospel, is 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, "For our sake, he, the Father, made him, the Son, to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." Right? This is the concept of double imputation, right? Our sin imputed to Christ on the cross. Our junk, our failures, and they are many, imputed to Christ at the cross, given to him. And Christ's righteousness, his perfection, his beauty, his majesty, imputed to us as a gift of his grace. Our sin to him, his righteousness to us. And on the basis of that double imputation of our sin to him and his righteousness to us, the Father declares over us innocent of all the charges. And that's the gospel. And this really happened in real space and real time, a little stretch of land in the Middle East 2,000 years ago. And that gives us hope today. Amen? Amen. Let me pray for us.